The following is a production of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
Next on Maine Watch, should food containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, be labeled as such? And should Maine become the first state in the nation to require those labels? A bill before the legislature would do just that. Plus, the effort to restore Maine streams and the brook trout in them by replacing problematic culverts. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Watch. The epicenter of the debate over genetically modified food shifted to Maine this week as the legislature took up a bill that would require all food containing GMOs to be labeled as such. Maine is one of about 20 states considering such legislation this year, and the bill has a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. Yet there are a number of farm and retail groups opposing it. At a public hearing earlier this week, more than 100 people presented testimony, the vast majority supporting a GMO labeling bill.
If you're going to engage the American public and the people of Maine in a lab experiment, you know, it's my opinion that perhaps they ought to know they're in that lab experiment. And because of the uncertainty that has been demonstrated in nearly every single independent test there is, that uncertainty warrants at least a labeling, not taking a position whether that labeling is good, not taking a position whether that labeling is bad, but demonstrating that labeling nonetheless.
The United States, however, unlike all other developed countries, does not require safety testing for genetically engineered plants, although it does require testing for engineered animals.
People want and have the right to know what they're eating.
To be honest, I don't think labeling GMOs is the best thing we can do. What we really should do is ban them.
Health and safety issues regarding food and food labeling are best legislated on the national level. Mandatory state labeling of products is unnecessary public policy and expensive for Maine farmers, processors, manufacturers, grocers, and the state to implement and to enforce.
If this is enacted, not just the cost of doing the regulating, but I'm concerned about the cost of our food budgets.
And joining me now to discuss this issue, Logan Perkins, who is an attorney who has been working with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and other groups to build support for this bill, and State Representative Jeffrey Timberlake, who serves on the Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry Committee and is a farmer who owns Ricker Hill Orchards. Thank you both for being here on Maine Watch. Logan, explain how this would work. Under this bill, exactly what would have to be labeled and why?
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer. The bill would require a label on any food that contains an ingredient that's from a genetically modified organism or itself is a genetically modified organism. So about 70% of processed foods in the grocery store contain some genetically modified ingredients. And then any whole food, which is a genetically modified, like an ear of sweet corn or a piece of zucchini or a papaya, or if genetically modified salmon were to be commercialized, the salmon would also have to be labeled.
But not seeds and not meat, right?
Well, the bill originally did require seed labeling, but yesterday we decided, and Representative Harvell, the sponsor of the bill, proposed to the committee when he introduced it, removing seeds from the bill. And that's because of the federal requirement that has to do with pesticide labeling, and many of the seeds to grow genetically modified organisms, like genetically modified corn, are themselves regulated as pesticides because they teach the plant to make a pesticide, and the plant itself actually is a pesticide and is regulated as such. And in that circumstance, the federal government has exclusive authority, and we can't, as a state, require labeling of seeds.
Okay, Representative Timberlake, your orchard already deals with different kind of labels. You grow organic apples and conventional apples and label them differently. But you see problems with this kind of labeling, that providing a different kind of label for a food product with GMO contents. What's the difference?
Well, you know, we do it at our choice. We don't have to put organic on our product if we don't want to. There's no law that requires if I sell it, it has to. But if I want to get a premium for my product, or I want the consumer to know that the product that I'm selling is organic, it benefits me to put it on. So it's my choice. There's no law that requires me to put organic on it. I can take organic apples and put them in my IPM apples and do the same thing. There's no law that requires it has to have an organic label on it. And my concern with this bill is that it puts Maine on an island by itself, and that Maine is a state with all sorts of us farmers throughout the state that are trying to compete across state lines. And if my farm or any other farm in the state of Maine in any product, whether it be organic or conventional, when it's grown at some point in time, it has a form of insecticide put on it. Well, that would be like me putting the word insecticide on my bag, and Maine was the only place that did it. Well, every mom and mother and so forth, when they get to the store, and housewife, and they pick up the bag and it said insecticide, they're going to put it back down.
So are you worried that a GMO label would seem like a warning label to people?
Yes, and that's where I come. It looks like a warning label. They're going to pick it up. It says GMO. People don't understand that there has, you know, there's all sorts of, I don't want to call it myth, but thought that GMO is bad for you, that GMO is not bad for you. I don't know whether it is or bad. I haven't seen any science that has proved that anybody has actually gotten sick or harmed from it. Nobody has given that to us yet. The committee has asked for that to be brought forward. So my theory is that but the problem is when you deliver it to the warehouse, and I deliver a product to a Walmart, a Hannaford, a Shop and Save, a Food City, whatever it is. When it goes to their warehouse, it goes in there, and we deliver a load with a label on it. And they're going to send that label across state lines because these guys deliver to New Hampshire, to Massachusetts, Vermont, whatever. And they can't distinguish when I take it in on a load because that means we'd have to break everything up, a lot of paperwork. They're going to refuse to do that. They're going to say, no, we're not going to buy from the Maine.
Right, so you don't know which apples are going to go to the Hannaford in New Hampshire and which in the Hannaford in Maine, and they'd all have the GMO label and you would be competing. But, Logan, this is an argument you've been hearing. What's your response to that?
Well, for one, Maine is never going to be an island under this bill. The bill, if it passes, would create a labeling requirement that only goes into effect when five states or states with a total population of 20 million people also have labeling laws. So we've avoided exactly the scenario that he's talking about by creating this trigger mechanism in the bill so that Maine doesn't become an island, so that Maine in its small market doesn't get left out in the cold by having a special standard.
I want to take a step back and look at the bigger picture a little bit here. Explain why so many people are troubled, Logan, by genetically modified food. I mean, we've grafted fruit plants for years. We hybridize. We buy all sorts of hybridized seeds at our local gardening center. What's the difference here?
It's a good question. There's a really big difference, and it's an important one for people to understand. The difference is that genetic engineering, which is what creates genetically modified organisms, for the first time in human history about 20 years ago, started introducing new and novel genes into the genetic sequence of food crops. For example, one of the first crops ever commercialized was a tomato with a fish gene in it. Other examples are bacterial genes inserted into corn plants, human genes inserted into rice plants, and spider genes inserted into, I can't remember which crop it is, but all sorts of different cross species and cross taxonomic lines, genetic manipulations that could never take place in nature, that could never take place through natural breeding or through the plant's own mechanisms of reproduction.
So are you, and I know that your concern is, but we don't know what the impact on the human being is from these. And I want to ask you this as well, Representative Timberlake. Are you concerned about the impact of genetically modified food on the human body?
I'm open to the science, but I don't think that there's been any documented proof today. And it's been around for 20 years, and there's all sorts of stories. Well, I took my child off this and did this, but did you feed them the exact same diet of not GMO product versus GMO product? So do you have the science? And to go back to one other thing in that was, she said, you know, there's five states. Well, the five states aren't connected. You know, you might get
not
a little
necessarily by
you,
the law.
You might get a little more connection if they was all interconnected. But it could be a state of Maine, Utah, Arizona, Texas, whatever. And it still puts us on that
island. So would you be more comfortable if this were going to be a federal law? If this were before the U.S. Well, Congress, would you not have a problem with the idea of labeling GMO?
I would have no problem with that, probably, because I'm not against necessarily labeling, but I think it ought to be held at the federal level, not at the state level.
And Logan, let me ask you that, because this is an issue that came up over and over during the public hearing. Why should Maine be the first in this? It does create, because we're a small state, a number of issues.
Well, I think Maine is a leader. Maine has always been a leader, as Maine goes. Our state motto is Dear Ago. And Maine people are concerned. You know, a scientific poll conducted in Maine earlier this year showed that 91% of Mainers support a labeling requirement. And the fact of the matter is, the federal government is not moving forward on this issue. People are concerned. People believe they have the right to know. People support a requirement for a label. And Maine should take the first step and lead the nation on this issue, as we've done in so many other ways, in particular in ways where the federal government is going the opposite direction.
Let me ask you a practical question. As a farmer, Jeffrey, I'm thinking to myself, well, it could create an opportunity for a farmer to say non-GMO, put the label that's already legal, non-GMO. Do you know when you procure seeds and when you procure seedlings whether or not they're GMO?
Yes. Yes, we do, because that has to be disclosed. And the label law is already available today, so that anybody who wants to label non-GMO in Maine can do that. And I agree with you in that. And our family has actually talked about going to actually labeling some of our product, you know, probably all of our product, because we don't have any GMO on the farm, to non-GMO and go out on that island. But again, you don't want to, we're in an industry together. We're all farmers throughout the state of Maine. It's not all about one person. It's not just about me. It's about the whole state, and the whole state is a character. And that we have talked about going to the non-GMO, to go to non-GMO on the label, which is legal today. Anybody can do it who wants to. And if the public demands it, it's a free enterprise bill. If the public demands it, then it'll happen. If the public doesn't want it, it will. You know, they talk
about.
But
Logan said there was a survey, 91% of the public wants it.
You and I both know how surveys work. Surveys are very tricky when they're wrote. It's how the wording is and how the questions ask. Anybody can make a survey. You know, we've all do political polls. We're all politicians in the fall. And you can poll somebody today and get this for an answer. And you can poll somebody tomorrow and get the other answer. It depends on how the question's asked. Do I think a majority of the people want GMO? I suspect it's probably
want GMO labeling.
Want GMO labeling. But I don't think it's 91%.
Okay. Logan, do you anticipate if this bill passes, and it's too early to say, but it seems likely, it has 121 co-sponsors, do you anticipate a challenge in the courts?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the companies who promote genetically modified foods and who own the patents on these foods are companies like Monsanto and DuPont. They're companies with very deep pockets and very long histories of litigating aggressively to protect that income. And I think it's likely that we would see a lawsuit because this is a new approach. And when you deal with a company like Monsanto, they're a bully and they love to sue. And they probably would. But Maine stands up to bullies. It's one of the reasons why we're so proud to be Mainers, that we don't tolerate bullying in this state.
And is this a concern for you, Representative?
As a legislator, I was sworn to uphold the Constitution of the state of Maine and the United States. And where, in my opinion, I'm not going to make a decision one way or the other how I'm going to go on this until after the Attorney General has rendered down her comments and her thoughts, and then that'll be taken in by the committee as a concern, whether it's for or against, or however it comes out, because I haven't seen her reports yet.
Right.
But there's been some talk that she is showing some concerns.
Interesting. And there really isn't any precedence, because no state has passed this law, right?
No.
That's right. Although the legal issues that are being raised are issues where the rules of law are set out fairly clearly and have been well defined by the courts. And we feel fairly comfortable that yesterday at the public hearing and throughout this process, we will continue to demonstrate the necessary state interest and the necessary factual basis that our legislature can rely on to pass this law and have it withstand a constitutional challenge.
Well, I have a feeling this is an issue we're not hearing the end of. It's very interesting. As someone who sat through most of the public hearing can tell you, Logan Perkins and Representative Jeffrey Timberlake, thank you so much for being here on Maine Watch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the years, dam removal in Maine has gotten a lot of attention, especially from groups looking to restore fish populations. But dams are not the only problems for fish. Often culverts and other obstacles impact their ability to navigate freshwater to spawn. A broad coalition known as Keeping Maine's Forests is working to improve stream corridors throughout Maine. Two of its directors join us now. Tom Rumpf is the acting state director of the Nature Conservancy, and Patrick Strauch is executive director of the Maine Forest Products Council. Thank you both for being here on Maine Watch.
Glad to be here.
Tom, how big of a problem is this for Maine? How many streams are blocked by poorly designed or malfunctioning culverts?
Well, Jennifer, first of all, we have to figure this out by doing surveys, culvert surveys. So we've had several different groups, state agencies and nonprofit groups, over the last several years have been doing surveys with landowner permission. And what they've found, they've surveyed over 10,000 road stream crossings around the state, which is only about 30% of the total or a third. And what they found is that of those ones that have been surveyed, roughly about a third create a serious impasse for fish. Another third could be a problem at different times of the year, and then the other third generally are not a problem. So it varies from place to place, but overall that's the rough breakdown.
Patrick, how long has this issue even been on the radar? We haven't been hearing about culverts for years.
Well, we've been working on culverts and road construction and erosion from logging sites for over 10 years, longer than that. But we've worked on best management practices that should be used in the woods. And as we began to identify our fisheries, we began to see that it wasn't just about putting in culverts that could last a long time. It was about the passageway for fish species. And as we identify the native brook trout populations that we have that are so special, we have increased interest in salmon fisheries, and all that came together towards the landowners working on being concerned about the way they were building roads, coupling the concern they had about erosion with fish passage, and really putting together an integrated system of maintenance and upgrading that road system.
So sort of a little bit on the radar for about a decade, but really building recently.
Yes.
To more awareness on this. I want to look at some photos of some of the kind of work that you're doing, and an example of the kind of culvert that can be a problem for fish. This is Belden Brook, and I don't think you need to be a scientist to understand how having the culvert above the waterline would impede fish passage. Tom, explain to me what we're looking at right here.
Well, this is an example of a culvert that we now know was improperly put in. At the time it was done, we didn't know that much about how to install culverts. Now we know we need to install them at the same grade as the stream so that when the water flows through, it doesn't create erosion effects. What's happened here was the culvert was just put at the bottom, and as water flows out the end, it actually scours out a pool on the downstream side and creates this hanging culvert, which most fish cannot jump up into.
So even though when it was installed, it may not have been above the water line.
Right.
As the years went by. Now, this is what happened at that site. It is clearly not a culvert anymore, a stream.
Yeah, in this case, the landowner here was seeking to relocate this road, and this particular road was being retired. So the stream was restored by removing the culvert and restoring a more natural profile to the stream.
Okay, and another project is Rolf Brook, another fairly typical project, I would say. It's a project in which the culvert has been blocked by, well, I can barely see it at all, but it looks like trees, stumps, and other natural debris.
Yeah, here you can see that on the upstream side, because of blockage of the culvert from woody debris, that it's actually created a pool. Instead of a flowing stream, you have a pool on the upstream side of the road. And in this case, what you needed was a larger passageway. And in some cases, given the size of the stream, you want to put in what is called a arch culvert, which is sort of like a half of a culvert. And so it is much wider. It allows for a lot more passage, and the stream can flow through pretty naturally.
And it kind of has a natural bottom instead of it being a corrugated metal. Does that make a difference for the fish?
That's actually one of the things when they're doing surveys and they look at existing culverts, they look to see if there's any sediment or stones in the bottom of the culvert is an indication that it's properly installed and they're not scoured out and pushed out by high flows.
How many projects have been done so far, and how many would you like to be doing?
Well, I mean, I think we don't have exact numbers because the Keeping Maine's Forest Group has done about 6 or 8 of these projects in the last couple years, and we have several planned for this summer. But there are many different groups working on this problem, nonprofits around the state, as well as state and federal agencies, and trying to work collaboratively with different landowners and with cities and towns. It's a real problem for municipalities because they don't have the funding, even though it's lower cost in the long run in terms of capital costs because you don't have to replace the culverts. It's more of an upfront cost, and many towns are having trouble coming up with that upfront money. But I think overall on private lands, there's actually been a lot more work done because of Keeping Maine's Forest, and that's because of the educational work that we've done, assisted by Maine Audubon, the Maine Forest Service, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and others. There have been a series of educational projects done around the state for landowners and road builders and towns to explain to them why it's important to maintain stream connectivity, both for the wildlife, but also to minimize the damage from big storms.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Go ahead, Patrick.
The partners in this are... The certification movement has been very big in Maine in terms of forest stewardship, and we have an opportunity through Keeping Maine's Forest, but also through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, working together with Audubon on workshops throughout the state.
Right.
And that's the genesis of Keeping Maine's Forest, bringing different groups together to kind of talk about collaboration instead of fighting about regulation. How can we build a real collaborative effort that makes a difference in the fisheries of Maine?
Well, that leads into my next question. You know, why is the Maine Forest Products Council interested in fish passage? I mean, why are you part of the coalition?
Well, it was an opportunity. I mean, Keeping Maine's Forest is a collection of unlikely people who have at times maybe been on opposite sides of the table. And it doesn't mean that we're all sitting together and agreeing on all the issues, but we're talking about it in the context of how do we help Maine's forests. And groups like the Audubon Society, AMC, Maine Forest Products Council, which represents about 9.5 million acres of commercial forest land, the Forest Society of Maine, Maine Tree. It's really a great group of people who, when they get together and start thinking about solutions, can come up with a variety of good projects. The conservation easement movement was really kind of the genesis of the group getting together and trying to figure out how to collaboratively get more conservation easements in Maine, because that's kind of the neutral ground between a private-public sort of collaboration in having lands sustained for forest management, but buying the development rights and sometimes the recreational opportunities forever.
Interesting. Have we seen a measurable difference in the population of fish in streams in Maine's rivers, or is it too early to know what kind of impact this has?
It's a little early to know, but part of the work often involves doing electrical shocking. Marine Resources, if it's a stream that has diatomous fish, which are fish that spend some time in the ocean and some time in streams, they will come and do the survey before and after, and so we can begin to get a handle on that sort of thing, but it's a little early in the process right now.
Patrick, what other kind of projects will Keeping Maine Forest, what do you have your eyes on for the future?
Well, we're always looking for ways to make a difference and to collaborate. I mentioned the conservation easements, and seeking funding for that kind of opportunity was important to the group, still is. Stream fish passage is important, and we've recently worked collaboratively on recreational information. We put together a brochure that'll be out and about, and people will be able to see it. Keeping Maine's Forest sponsored a brochure that explains what your trip into the North Maine woods is going to be like, and what a match we have between a working forest and environment and a lot of recreational opportunities in some beautiful territory. So,
Tom, what should a private landowner take away from the kind of work that you're doing here, especially with the streams and the culverts? Should people be looking at their own property a little differently than maybe they used to?
Yeah, I mean, what we found is that by having a collaborative process like this where we're communicating with private landowners, we're learning from them and they're learning from the biologists and others, and we're getting some innovation. In fact, to be honest, there's probably been more work done voluntarily by landowners because of the educational efforts that Patrick mentioned and through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, which has a sort of a continuous improvement component. And so a lot of landowners have taken it on themselves to do better stream passage as they do their regular road maintenance on their land. And we've also getting some innovations. Recently, there's been a development where a company called Dirigo Lumber or something like that, Dirigo Timberlands, has developed a concrete. You saw this steel arch culvert. Mm-hmm. They created a concrete arch culvert, which is no more expensive than a 38-inch culvert, normal culvert. And it can meet the same sort of ideal as this at much lower cost. So with those sort of improvements can allow us to do a lot more. And actually, it's better for landowners in the long run because they make these types of improvements, their roads will last longer.
All right. Well, Tom Rumpf, Patrick Strouk, thank you so much for being here on Maine Watch with us.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about any topic on Maine Watch, you can head to our website where we provide web links. That is mpbn.net/MaineWatch. Also, we're on Facebook. Be sure and like us at MPBN Maine Watch with Jennifer Rooks. Thank you for joining us.